Alrighty, welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 9. And this semester I've decided just to number the lectures, so whilst it says module in the notes, they don't line up with the chapters. And I'm very sorry about that, but it means I get to talk about what I want when I want without worrying about what chapter we're actually up to. As a matter of fact, we're looking at Module 7 this week. I'm just going to decrease my sensitivity by a smidge because this is keying off on me.
Where's
with sensitivity? Is it the lower the more sensitive is, or the higher? Yeah, that's what I thought. All right. Does anybody have any questions, queries, etc., on any of the stuff we have covered up to this point, or anything they would like to ask me about? A note that Lab 6.7.2 or so looks as though it can be done without modification. That's the subnetting one, so that doesn't have to be modified, and I'll be moving that into the "Yes, I modified it" section. So certainly, plenty of work to go on with, guys. I haven't seen a lot of the labs from many of the students, and I won't be identifying anybody specifically at this particular point in time as we are recording, but suffice it to say that I should possibly be seeing a few more labs soon, and I will hopefully go on believing that, unlike Santa Claus. Now, any questions? Alrighty. I am in the chat window. This is a good day. Alrighty. We're going to look at Module 7 today, which concerns itself with the data link layer. As you will well know, we've been wandering our way down through the OSI reference model over the last few weeks. We started off at the application layer. We went down to the session, presentation, transport, network, and we are now down to data link. It is very important that everybody knows the layers of the OSI reference model, and it's one of those annoying things that you just about have to rote learn before you get it. It took me quite a while, to be honest. But once you know them, you can say interesting things like, that seems like a layer 4 problem. And as long as you're not making things up as you go along, people will think you're pretty clever. Alrighty, so it's got a summary of the layers above the data link layer. It says the application layer provides the interface to the user. The transport layer manages and deals with communications between various processes on end systems. Network layer protocol allows traffic to travel across networks. And the data link network sits between the network layer and the physical layer. So we're going to explain the role of data link protocols in transmission. We're going to talk about how we prepare data for transmission on the network media. Describe the different types of media access and control methods. And in fact, if you're looking at Module 7, you'll see that I've actually copied and pasted this list of objectives straight out of there because it was quicker than typing them. Describe different logical topologies and how logical topologies determines the media access control method for that network. And we're going to talk about why we encapsulate packets into frames, talk about the layer 2 frame structure, and talk about the frame fields such as quality of service, frame check sequence, etc. Alrighty. Before we get started, can anybody give me an example of a protocol that operates at the data link layer? Anybody got any examples of protocols that might operate at the data link layer?
ARP.
It actually operates at layer 2 and layer 3, but I'll give you that one. ARP is a good example. I'm thinking of something that starts with E.
Well, I suspect you're thinking of Ethernet, but I thought that was mostly a physical thing, because it sort of talked about the characteristics of the electronics and the distance and various things?
Well, actually, there's a couple of protocols for Ethernet. There's the 802.2 protocol, and then there's the 802.3. And what you actually find is that a lot of the specifications for Ethernet, whilst there are the physical specifications as far as cables and distances and stuff, you also have Ethernet frames which operate at the data link layer. And actually the data link layer is split into two sublayers. One is the media access control layer, or the MAC layer, and the other one is LLC, which is logical link control. And you'll find that those framing sequences and those sorts of things happen at the data link layer and are actually part of the Ethernet standard, but they're your 802.2, 802.3 frame standards. They're the things that say that you can have a maximum of 1,514 bytes per frame. You're dealing with things like, I don't know whether anybody, Brian's probably old enough to remember, and I certainly am, but if you've ever loaded up IPX drivers, they tend to go on about the frame types and stuff that can be supported on the particular media back in the bad old DOS days.
Yeah, Novell did that, which was IPX, and Lantastic had it too. You could play with the frame types.
Yeah, because apparently the default frame type for a lot of Ethernet was 802.3 if you were running IPX, SPX, and then it was actually Ethernet underlined 2 if you were running TCP, IP, and all those sorts of bad things, and it's all gotten a bit simpler now to a degree. But that sort of stuff all happens at the data link layer. The physical layer specifications for Ethernet, which I think are the 802.2 standards, deal with your distances and your 802.5 and your 802.10 and your 802.15, 802.11 even, and your 802.15, which is your Bluetooth stuff. That tends to take, that tends to happen at the physical layer, but then you go up into things like the data link standards, such as your frame check sequence, how you're going to wrap the frames up, what sort of headers and trailers you're going to have, maximum fray length. MTU is actually a data link concept. So as you can see, things get a bit blurry in some situations. So for example, ARP, because it's a protocol that maps hardware addresses, well, a hardware address actually, a MAC address, is at the data link layer, and it is a physical address of a network card as opposed to a logical address, because it's generally burned into EEPROM and copied into RAM when the network card boots. Obviously there are ways of overriding the MAC address, but we're not going into that at this particular point. So yeah, you end up with these sort of protocols that operate at the data link layer, so things can get a bit murky when we map real world to the data link layer. Okay, it says here that it uses media access control and error detection techniques. We'll flesh that out in a minute. The frame is the PDU for this layer. Remember we talked about bits, frames, packets, segments, data. I think that's all of them. Bits, frames, packets, segments, data. Yeah, that's them. We call the term for a station at this layer is a node. Okay, so at layer 3, we called them hosts. We called them hosts because they had the ability to use IP addresses and run various services, whereas at layer 2, we call them nodes. We're dealing with a physical network as opposed to the logical network, so we're dealing with our hubs and our switches and things like that. The physical network is how cables and things are set up. And the logical network is how we arrange the network as far as hierarchical addresses. So the physical network will deal with how many computers you've got connected into a particular switch, how many switches are connected to other switches, the physical version of what's connected to a router, not necessarily the IP addresses and stuff. And I'm going to have to drop that sensitivity even lower, I think. Stupid thing. All right, let's see. Alrighty, let's try this. My notes. Okay, now the point of the data link layer is it allows the upper layer protocols to put data on the network without concerning themselves with the media type and the characteristics of that media. So say you've got packets that are travelling from one host to another, you don't have to really concern yourself with the fact that it's optical fibre, wireless, ADSL, etc. You are just concerning yourself with getting the data onto the network, and the data link layer takes care of the details of getting that stuff onto the wire in whatever format that it needs to be. So they govern how it's going to format frames for different media. Most medias do not reformat Ethernet frames, although I think wireless actually puts extra header information on over and above the Ethernet frames. And I think technically you can have 2,346 bytes per wireless frame, whereas generally speaking the MTU for Ethernet is set around 1,500. Anybody got any questions so far? You do? I've just been told that gigabit networking changes the Ethernet frame because you can have a minimum frame size of 512 bytes, you can send frames in bursts, and there are other changes that we can't quite remember until we look up the Wikipedia article right at this point in time. Media access control controls how frames get on and off the media. So you have a card or a device which has a card or an interface that controls the way this happens. So, for example, if you think of printers with network cards in them, the printers don't seem to concern themselves with the network card. It's usually the network card and stuff that worries about how to talk over the network, like those JetDirect cards and stuff like that. So frames are created and formatted differently for each type of media that you're putting them on. Is he gone? Yeah, he did that last week too. Like
no.
Yeah. Sorry, okay, we have to bit of recording editing we'll have to do here. It's all good. Now frame has header data and trailer. So if you've got, if you're looking at, say, Ethernet frames, for example, you've got the preamble, you've got the destination MAC address, you've got the source MAC address, you've got the destination IP address, you've got the source IP address, etc. Frames can contain start and stop indicator fields. Well, sorry, what I was going to say before we got that interruption was when I was talking about the different types of frames and the different way that frames were formatted, you are probably aware that over different network topologies you have different types of frames. So Bluetooth frames look a bit different to Ethernet frames. PPP frames look a bit different to say frames that go over optical fiber. So if, for example, you were running point-to-point over Ethernet, you would find that the frames would look actually different to regular Ethernet frames because they are actually a payload of point-to-point data. Just an unrelated question. Randy, did you get my tweet about the Cavi virtual machines?
I did.
Excellent. Well, if you install one of those, it has a pre-configured Apache all ready to go. And if you change it from network address translation to bridged, it will turn up on your local network and you can do horrible things to it.
Excellent.
I realise it is a Debian box, not a Red Hat box, but, well, you know. There are naming and addressing fields in a frame. The type field, in other words, it'll tell you whether it's Ethernet 2 or 802.3. Control flow control services, so you've got various frames that can quench the flow of data and stuff. You also have hardware methods of flow control on networks as well. there was sort of in the bad old days, I don't know whether anybody remembers when gigabit first came in, but not everything supported, or even with 100 megabit stuff. I remember paying $143 for a 5-port switch back in 1999 for 100 megabit. They were D-Link too. I suppose it's probably also not worth mentioning that both of the power supplies went but the switches were fine. Anyway, I digress. Not everything supported flow control. Not everything supported N-way auto detection negotiation. And you basically had to override certain settings on certain cards and things to make things go. Has anybody been into the advanced properties of their network card under Windows to have a look at the sort of things you can tamper with?
All the time, because for some reason my Windows 7 PC, which has a Realtek, I think it's a Realtek chip, I forget now, I have to look it up quickly in Device Manager, but it seems to be forever reverting to 100 megabit, and my switch is gigabit, and the cable's good. I changed it for another Cat 5 cable, and everything else goes at 1,000, except my PC, which used to go at 1,000 and now seems to be stuck. And I cannot figure out why.
Interesting. Couple of things I would check. I would make sure you have the latest Realtek drivers from softpedia.com, because don't even bother with the Realtek site unless you have to. It's slew. So Realtek 816 whatever drivers, they will be newer than the Microsoft ones, because it takes a while for Microsoft to okay them. And then what I'd probably do is install those, and you might find that a lot of your problems go away, but it's worth a try. Obviously, take a restore point before you do this, but Realtek does actually fix their drivers, and shock of all shocks and horrors, there is actually a change log in each of the Realtek driver distributions that tells you what they fixed from version to version, including the sound drivers. So, whilst a lot of people rubbish Realtek, I really can't fault them too much because they're basically doing the best they can with the hardware that they've got, and they do maintain and fix their drivers, which is more than I can say for companies like, for example, Creative. I mean, the other thing that could have happened, and I'm saying this purely as a joke, but perhaps Realtek thought you needed to save a couple of milliwatts of power, so they've wound you back to 10-100, so that you don't use up too much power. So you may actually seriously want to look at the power saving options and try toggling them off, and see whether that gives you a higher link beat speed as well.
Yeah, I actually have. I've played with that. I played with the Magic Packet stuff. I wondered if there was a BIOS setting, which I don't have an easy way of checking at the moment. I don't think so. But it's actually not Realtek. It's an Atheros L1.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, so it's an Atheros.
Atheros L1.
Okay. Well, see, there we go. See, I bet you the Realtek one just works, and the Atheros doesn't. Do a free scan on Driver Guide. You can do the scan for free, and then you can go and rat up the Atheros drivers yourself off Softpedia if there are newer ones. I mean, we love Driver Guide. We bought it, but I mean, each to their own. The free scan does a great job. So that is driverguide.com. We love Driver Guide.
Is it accessible? Because the amount of this kind of stuff that I do, I'd probably be prepared to pay for it. But the one when I used it several years ago, they had captchas and various things, and it was god awful and hard to find things.
No. This is a little utility. You run it, and it says sending data to driver guide, and then it sits there for about 5 seconds, and then it goes, launches up a copy of Internet Explorer, and there's a web page with all the drivers listed, with download links next to each of them, and then there's a link down the bottom that says download zip of all suggested drivers. So that's probably about as accessible as you're going to get. We like it a lot.
I'd happily pay for that. It would save an immense amount of time. But just like I brought that 9-8 Pro, that's lovely.
Yeah, we've thought about buying the 9-8 Pro, actually. I haven't actually done it yet, but it's very cool. And you can actually get the stuff downloaded into the installers if you've got the Pro version. You either get the installer that grabs the stub installers that grabs it off the net, or it actually grabs all the programs and bundles them up. But yeah, it lets you scan 10 PCs on Driver Agent. That's one of the subscriptions. You can get subscriptions for more, but they do expire the PCs you scan out really quickly. So you'd be I'd be very surprised if you managed to use up all 10 scans at once. I think it's about $40 a year.
Yeah, that's what it was. It saved us. It really...
Yeah, we had somebody bring in a laptop and they had like Vista on it. And there's just some people you can't help. And they're just like, oh, my wireless card doesn't work and I don't have any drivers for this and the mouse isn't working properly. And, well, let's just say half an hour later with Driver Guide, we had a happy user and the laptop did everything it was supposed to, obviously. Sometimes you'll get a wonky driver. Like sometimes they'll give you an unusual driver that probably shouldn't have come down. They bundled up some Netgear FA311 drivers into the zip that really shouldn't have been there, and I don't know why that is. I should really write to support and find out. But with an automatic XP install disk, we took Aiden from Go. On the weekend, and we scanned him with Driver Agent, and that got all the drivers down he needed for the computer he'd been donated, and saved us hours of hunting down each individual driver. Because one of the really annoying things, and it's kind of not lecture-related, but sue me, you get these devices that show up in other devices, and then you get the PCI and vendor IDs, and then you've got to go and get either a utility or Google to find out who actually made the card, unless you basically get annoyed and boot a copy of GRML, which will tell you, and then you go looking for the drivers for everything. So handy nifty trick if you don't have one of these list PCI utilities, and to be honest, I don't know of a good one. If somebody knows of one, I'd be interested to know. For Windows, I usually just boot GRML, hit tab, type SW speak, and then run LSPCI. But then again, that's just me. Alrighty. So we're going to get back into the content that's in these notes. And the notes mention here that the data link layer is broken into two layers, the logical link control and the media access control. The media access control are methods such as CSMA-CD, which is carrier sense multiple access with collision detection, and CSMA-CA, which is carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance. And they do that on wireless networks because of the way wireless networks are set up and how they talk to the access points and stuff. And the reason they do this is so you can have IPX, SPX, TCP/IP, etc., all travelling on the same Ethernet media. So, the logical link sublayer frames the network packet, identifies the network layer protocol, the media access control sublayer addresses the frame, marks the beginning and end of the frame. Now, the data link layer is not really defined by RFCs. So, you've got the engineering organizations. They're the ones who do this sorts of stuff. So you're looking at IEEE and all that sort of thing. So then the organizations you're looking at here, you're looking at International Organization for Standards, the Institute of Electronic and Electrical Engineers. I think it's electrical and electronic, actually. American National Standards Institute, which is ANSI. So if ever you wanted to know what ANSI.sys stood for, you now know. International Telecommunications, ITUT, and yes, it's Swiss, which is why it doesn't actually stand for what the acronym is, because it's not English. I saw a tweet the other day that said I want to paint my bedroom something neutral. Perhaps Switzerland will be a good colour. Media control techniques. This is how you share the media if it's shared at all, and the rules for actually getting the frames onto the media, how it's actually going to do that. So you're looking at control and contention. Who's got the right to transmit? When have they got the right to transmit? How long can they transmit? And what are the rules for making sure that somebody doesn't hog the media entirely? You've got two types of media access control, deterministic and non-deterministic. Now, a deterministic method of flow control is one that can guarantee specific bandwidth for specific hosts or nodes, I should say, at a particular point in time. And non-deterministic is one that attempts to give hosts or nodes good amounts of bandwidth, but doesn't guarantee anything. Token ring is deterministic. And CSMACD is non-deterministic. Any questions so far or comments?
But token ring is deterministic. Okay, I can get that. But how does that, if someone has the token, what prevents them from keeping it? Is there some interval that it expires or something?
Yes, and for example, if you don't actually. If you don't actually, Grace, here. If you don't actually let the token go in a certain amount of time, the MAUs consider that the link's broken, and then they isolate that workstation off the network, and that's the end of that. I think we actually have a Thursday chat in the 2007 area that deals with Token Ring, if you're ever interested in the gory details. Ian actually did some research and gave a chat on it. It's actually fascinating. Like that sort of thing. Okay, so if two packets get sent at once, you get a collision. Packets get corrupted, the packets need to be retransmitted. If you get too many collisions, the throughput is impacted and the efficiency of the network decreases. I believe CSMA CD is efficient up to about 60% of network utilization. Then you start seeing fall-offs in performance, which is why you tend to use lots of switches and stuff these days because they alleviate a lot of the collision problems with CSMA CD. Okay, now CSMA CD is an interesting contention protocol. It basically stands for Carrier Sense Multiple Access with Collision Detection. Carrier sense means that a device is going to listen to the wire and see if anybody's transmitting, and it's going to do that by looking at the voltage. It's going to then not transmit if it sees that somebody else is transmitting. The multiple access means that lots of people get access to the media. And the collision detect is where we look for an overvoltage condition and go, "Oh, we got a collision, send a jam signal." Now, I don't know whether anybody remembers back to the sort of the rules of polite conversation, which I don't know whether they still exist in 2011. But if you think about a dinner party and you're having a discussion around the table, the theory is that you will listen to see if anybody else is talking, and you would then wait for a period of silence, and then you would start talking. And then, if you start talking and somebody else starts talking, you both go quiet for a while and see who decides to get the nerve up to get talking first. I don't know if anybody remembers as a kid, but I was always told you had to wait for a gap in conversation before you could potentially interrupt. What they didn't tell you was that there usually wasn't a gap in conversation when your parents were talking, and you couldn't. So that was essentially like a perpetual jam signal. Okay, so my
I
notes
just
here
got through listening
say.
to a political debate that, well, I learned how it's not supposed to work.
Oh, yeah, sorry, go ahead. Yeah, political debate where it's not supposed to work. They were talking over each other, were they?
No, constantly. It's, I mean, I've been in classrooms with little kids that were better, had better etiquette. Anyway, sorry. OT.
No, that's relevant. That's relevant. That's all right. Or because what I was actually going to say was that the other problem with interrupting people, and I suppose this happens if you're... Well, it happens on networks too. If you're talking or you're trying to talk or you've got this amazing idea you need to unload, you've actually stopped listening to the other person because you're so focused on what it is you have to say. Next week, we'll replace Cavi with 101 Communications. No, we won't. Okay, CSMACD listens to the media and it sees if there is no signal. If no signal is seen, the device transmits. If two devices transmit, then devices wait random time and try again. If 15 retransmits fail, frame is dropped. Okay, so that means the frame is actually dropped. This means that if the frames are dropped, you need to hand this to higher level protocols. So it is actually feasible and possible on a badly configured network with jabbering transceivers that you will actually lose frames at the data link layer, and it is up to protocols such as IP to actually deal with the retransmissions. It is actually possible for UDP packets to go missing on Ethernet. It's very rare, but it can actually happen. Okay, point-to-point protocols, they don't tend to require control rules. You've got one device at one end of the point-to-point link and another device at the other, and if the link is full duplex, then both devices can transmit at once. If the device, the link is half duplex, then one device can transmit in one direction, and then the other device can transmit in the other direction. We're going to quickly define full duplex, half duplex, and simplex. Simplex, device transmits one way all the time, such as radio station, television station, etc. Half duplex is where a data channel can run in one direction at a time, so you can either send or you can receive. There is often a turnaround delay on a half duplex link, which needs to be considered in the design of protocols. For example, if you're sending a radio signal to the moon and back, and no, I'm not going to break into that song about the girl that's going to the moon and back. You have quite a round-trip delay, and you need to actually use windowing, otherwise it can take 1.5 seconds for your acknowledgement packets to come back. And if you've ever used satellite, then you'll know exactly what I'm talking about, because it suffers from those sorts of problems. We actually had a problem with satellite with one of our students in 2007, where Skype worked fine because it used UDP and whatever else, but Ventrilo was absolutely unintelligible. Full duplex, devices can transmit in both directions simultaneously, and there were some old BBS protocols, if anybody remembers, such as Bimodem, that would allow you to upload and download stuff at the same time. And they're actually UUCP protocols that let you do that. You don't tend to think about it on TCP these days because everything just happens. But back in the old days when transmit direction was important, you would tend to know what was going on at any particular point in time. Any questions or comments on that? Is anybody still awake? Go ahead.
Do they still have things like... I remember from the old dial-up days where you had the different protocols had different flow control mechanisms, where they had like software ones where you had to transmit the X characters to X modem. And it... I guess they sort of don't really do it that way anymore. It's all at lower layers.
Well, you'll tend to see certain levels of flow control, so they're sort of implemented sort of closer into the hardware and stuff. There are certainly flow control methods for things like ADSL and stuff, but it's all sort of transparently handled by the modems and stuff at a lower level, so we don't have to deal with the vagaries of software and hardware flow control. And yeah, the characters it used to send were X on, which was control Q, and X off, which was control S, obviously for stop. So if you have stuff scrolling on your screen under Linux, I believe you can, if you've actually got those flow control methods in enabled, which you usually don't, you still can press Control S and the scrolling of the text will stop in a lot of situations, and then Control Q will start it up again. Alrighty, we're talking about the logical versus the physical topology. Now, the physical topology is how the computers are actually wired together. Are they wired in a ring? Are they wired in a bus? Are they wired in a star? Are they wired in a mesh? And a mesh is where you've got every computer connected to every other computer. Sorry, does somebody want to say something? Somebody's keyed. Ah, there we go. Not now. Okay. So, your physical topology is how they're actually wired together. So, say for example, you've got a hub and a number of workstations. They are physically considered a star. However, if you've got a hub that doesn't do any arbitration, well, it does a certain amount of arbitration, but it doesn't do any segmenting and stuff. It sends the packet out every other port except for the port that the packet came in on. You actually have a logical bus, but a physical star. So the network appears physically as a star, but it appears logically as a bus because on a hub, every other workstation will see the packets from every other workstation.
Can you still get them? Because I was thinking when we're doing all this playing with T-Shark and stuff, it might be kind of cool to look at some of that stuff, but on a switch, you can only see things destined for your segment.
The way I got around it was you can actually get Linksys, I think they're about $100 or less, 8-port switch with a little web interface in them, and you can actually assign one of the ports as monitor port, and it gets all of the traffic from all the other workstations shoveled out that port, so you can see it all. I'll get you a model number just out of morbid curiosity, but that's probably your best method of doing switchy hubby things. And these things are actually sort of manageable in a limited sort of way. They're kind of nifty. I just can't remember the exact model number now, but they are the one with the web interface, and you can set VLANs and quality of service stuff on them and stuff. And they're quite cheap.
Yeah, I actually have a 4-port D-Link one that has a web interface and stuff. It's buried in a box in the basement, but I wonder if it has that function. Maybe I'll pull it out and check.
It might. I know a lot of the Cisco switches have the ability to shovel everything off to management ports and stuff. But the cheap Linksys stuff does it too. Anything that doesn't have management doesn't tend to have that option, generally speaking. Alright, point-to-point can be connected together by a virtual circuit. So the packets can go through various devices and things, but essentially it's still point-to-point. So you don't really need the arbitration method there as such. Multi-access topology needs your arbitration method that we were talking about. We've kind of talked a little bit about token passing, but basically it's the token gets passed around the ring or whatever. Ian's lost his token, apparently. And if you've got FDDI, it can go around in... You've got two tokens, one goes in one direction and one goes in the other, and that's one of the ways you can detect breaks in sort of fiber and stuff. It's kind of nifty. Depending on the environment, depends on how much error checking and all that sort of stuff, and the amount of overhead differs. Now, the frame header contains information that's specific to the environment. So, for example, physical addresses, starter frame delimiters, end of frame delimiters, those sorts of things. So here's an example of some of the frames you can have in a field header. Start frame field, which I just spoke about. Sourced and destination addresses, often these can be MAC addresses if you're looking at Ethernet. Priority or quality of service field, in other words, how fast has this stuff got to get there. A type field, which protocol is going to handle this from the upper layer of the stack. Logical connection control field, which is used to establish the logical connection between a couple of hosts. The physical link control field, which is used to establish the link, and there is actually what's called a pre-link pulse, or PLP, that exists on Ethernet, which is how you can get your N-way auto negotiation and stuff working, and that's how it tells if there's actually a link there or not. It's a bit like line sync on ADSL. If you don't have line sync, you're not going anywhere. Flow control, used to start and stop traffic over media. I should probably mention again, mentioned a few times, if your ISP is insistent that you find out which lights are on and off on your modem, may I suggest the Light Probe app for the iThing. Works very well. I think it's 99 cents. And it uses the camera on the iThing as a light probe. And yes, I've used it for LEDs. Congestion control field, that is on some protocols, it's meant to show when the media is overloaded, and it shows that things have to slow down a bit. Now, physical addresses are used at the data link layer. They are not hierarchical. So if you think about it, whilst the MAC address is broken into two segments, the first 24 bits being the organizational unique identifier and the last 24 bits specific to a particular station, that's about as complex as it gets. You can't really tell where a machine is by looking at its MAC address. So, and physical addresses are only relevant to the segment that they're on. So you don't see MAC addresses when packets go through routers. And you don't see MAC addresses on other network segments. So theoretically, if devices were separated by a router on completely separate segments, you could have multiple devices with the same MAC address. I wouldn't recommend it though. The other thing to mention is if ever you're looking for your Wi-Fi address or your Bluetooth address for your iThing, it's located under About, under the Settings screen. And I didn't know that, but that's if you need to hack them into the router or something to allow static allocation of addresses, that is one way that that can be achieved. Now, trailers are used for the end of frame markers. They're also used for error detection. The frame check sequence goes at the end of the frame because it kind of makes sense that you can't calculate the error check sequence until you've received the entire frame, so we might as well stick the FCS at the end. Cyclic redundancy check. It basically does a big long binary divide of the message by a particular polynomial, and it gets a number that changes a lot when the bits changes, and that's all I'm going to say about it. But they can usually be 16 or 32 bits wide, and if you want more security than a cyclic redundancy checksum can provide, you start looking at hash algorithms. Cyclic redundancy checks have a high probability of detecting errors on a finite block size. So, for example, you may use a cyclic redundancy check for a 1500 byte frame, but the more bytes you use for the cyclic redundancy check, say for example 2000, 4000, 8000 bytes, the less likely you are to detect a particular error. Any questions so far?
Is the CRC, is that how this sort of, I've seen it lots of times with files that you download that have MD5 checksums, and I suspected it was sort of the same, similar mathematical model, but maybe not.
Similar but different. A hash algorithm is more complex than a cyclic redundancy check. A cyclic redundancy check is a simple binary long division that's usually implemented in... It's usually table-driven if it's implemented in software. If you see this byte, you'll get this result back, so we just run through and look the table up. And in hardware, it's usually done with shift registers. So, for example, cyclic redundancy checks are used on Ethernet to make sure that frames aren't corrupted. They're very quick to calculate in hardware, and they're very cheap. A cryptographic hash algorithm such as MD4, MD5, there are actually multiple message digest algorithms. In fact, rsync uses MD4s instead of MD5s because it was felt that you didn't need MD5 for what they were doing. They actually do a lot more messing around, and they actually hash up bits of the data and do calculations across the whole file. And the collision likelihood of something like MD5 is extremely low. So you're looking at 128-bit hash of your data. Apparently MD5 has been cracked, and you can actually get software that will generate the same data stream, different data streams with the same MD5 checksum, but it is very rare. The MD5 checksum is actually used to ensure that files came down correctly. You often see it on Windows, on Linux, Linux CDs and stuff, because we have an MD5 sum that comes with text utils. You are now starting to see it on things like Windows, and there are MD5 sum utilities for Windows. They ensure that the file you've got is actually the file that you've downloaded. And as far as I recollect, and I'd have to look this up, BitTorrent does an MD5 checksum on each block that it downloads. Alright, we have examples of data link protocols. So, for example, Ethernet, point-to-point protocol, high data link level control protocol, HDLC, frame relay, asynchronous transfer mode, etc. Now, we talk about LANs being using high bandwidth, small geographic area, and we are talking about wide area networks that use lower bandwidth and generally bigger distances. This needs to be mentioned because a lot of organizations think that they are going to be able to mix networks together over long distances and have protocols such as SIFS function reliably. And I remember that my ex-father-in-law was terrified by the thought of file sharing because he'd been on the tax LAN and it took ages to get files from Sydney over this horrible SIFS thing. So it's important that if you are going to do things over wide area networks that you look at the impacts and the protocols that you're going to use. Funnily enough, mapping a network drive over a high latency wide area network is generally not going to be a good user experience unless you implement it correctly. Okay, Ethernet standardized by 802.2, 802.3 standards. So you're looking at speeds from 10 megabits per second to 10 gigabits per second. Extremely popular. Lots of people use Ethernet. Ethernet frames used across all different types of Ethernet LANs. I've talked about the MAC address, 48 bits long, 24 bits for manufacturer or OUI, 24 bits for the specific station number. If you've played with T-Shark at all, you will note that it tries to dereference the manufacturers of the cards in its verbose dump. If you haven't, give it a try. Ethernet does not acknowledge frames, but it does check them. So often you'll get a statistic on how many CRC errors you've got. I know Linux ifconfig does it. I'm not sure about Windows. I think it does, actually. But it's up to the high-level protocols such as IP to deal with packet retransmission. Wireless networks have different protocols. Even though MAC addresses are used, there is no notion of actual connection. Frames are acknowledged on wireless. And that's all I have for today's notes. Any questions, discussions, comments before we hit stop on the recording for today?